overloaded word that it's very hard to come up with a good definition. And if you think about it, there are a couple of flavors of trust. There's a personal intimate form of trust. Right? When I say I trust a friend, it's not really about their specific actions, it's really about who they are as a person. When I'm trusting a friend, I'm trusting who they are, what I know about them, and that they will behave in a generally trustworthy manner, right? That their actions will be informed by who they are as a person. I'm entrusting their intentions, maybe their, you know, who they are, their personality. Right? It's a very personal trust. That's not what I'm talking about here, right? You know, when I got into the taxi cab, I didn't know the cab driver. Right? I didn't know his intentions. For all I knew, he was a bank robber at night. Right? And think about it, I didn't actually care. Right? He could be a nighttime bank robber. All I cared about is he'd, you know, drive the cab from this hotel to that hotel and charge me the amount on the meter, which wasn't fixed. I would pay it. He'd let me leave. Right? That's a very different form of trust. Right? It's not about their motivations or their personality. It's about their future actions. Right? I trust that in the context of the taxi cab, that the driver will behave in a trustworthy manner. Right? I don't know if he wants to steal. I mean, I don't know anything about him. And you know, you could argue that's not really trust. You know, maybe that's confidence. And maybe that taxi driver isn't really trustworthy. Maybe he's more compliant. Right? A lot of other flavors of words you can use here. In another sense, I'm reducing trust to consistency. Right? I want a consistent taxi cab experience. And I'm trusting that I'll get that with every random taxi in the Atlanta area. Or predictability. And when people are trustworthy in this way, I mean, this very narrow form of trust, I call them cooperative. That's the word I'm using, and it's from game theory, and I'll talk about that a bit later. So in today's society, right, we have to trust not only people, but institutions and systems. I mean, yesterday I flew on an airplane. I trusted that the airplane pilot would fly the plane properly and get me to Atlanta without crashing, right? But I actually didn't really. I kind of trusted the airline that produced him. Right? I'm trusting that Delta Airlines can, you know, has some system for producing trained, competent, and well-rested pilots that sit in front of airplanes at the appropriate time and fly me places. And I'm trusting the company. It's not really that I trusted the particular taxi driver. Right? I mean, I landed at the airport, I get into a taxi, and I'm trusting the system that produced him. But there is some taxi cab accreditation system in this city, and I don't know, you inspect cars and they're painted yellow. I don't know what it is. But whatever that system is, it will produce trustworthy taxis at the appropriate time, and I can use them. You know, I remember last time I was in China, I put my card into an ATM machine, and even though, right, I'm in China, I'm trusting this magic cash transfer system, right, that will produce yuan in the tray and debit a similar amount on my account in the United States. And I couldn't even tell you how the system worked. But I trusted it. And we all do. We'll use an ATM machine here and not even think about it. There are a lot of companies involved in that. All right, so back to this cooperation, this notion of cooperation. All complex systems require cooperation. And this is true for biological systems. This is true for social systems. This is true for socio-technical systems. Right? Complex systems do not work without cooperation of some form. It might not be conscious cooperation. Right? But there are cooperative pieces that together create the system. Right? If in an automobile, all those systems cooperate. Right. They're not volitional, but they're all working together to produce the emergent property of an automobile. Now, when you have individuals, unlike a car, more of an ecosystem or a social system, right, in any one of those cooperative systems, there is always an alternative parasitic strategy. And these can be tapeworms in your digestive tract. These could be thieves in the dealer's room. These could be spammers on email. These can be companies that take profits offshore and avoid taxes. Right? In any cooperative system, there's an alternative strategy of not being cooperative. Right? In the system here of you know, everyone sitting quietly, right, there's another strategy of someone who wants to get his message out to stand up and start protesting. Right? And it can be a very effective strategy. Right? We'll all hear what he said. Right? The tapeworm's digestive tract will do very well. Right, pickpockets in the dealer's room, you know, I don't know what they're making, but it's not going to be zero. So again, using game theory, I'm going to call those parasites defectors. Now, if you know any game theory, you'd recognize that my terms reflect the prisoner's dilemma. And the prisoner's dilemma, I think, is a really good metaphor to look at this notion of cooperative systems and parasites, of cooperators and defectors. For those who don't know, the prisoner's dilemma is a thought experiment that pits self-interest group versus group interest. I'm not going to go through the game theory, but the basic idea is that the system does well if everybody cooperates. The system does an individual does best if he defects and the other cooperates, but if both parties defect, the system fails. Catastrophically. Another way to think of this is the tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons. It's a very similar thought experiment. We'll do it with fisheries. Right? If we all limit our catch when we fish, the fishery stays healthy for generations to come. If we overfish, the fishery dies. Right? But if I overfish and you guys don't, fishery stays healthy, but I get more fish. So there's an enormous amount of work on this. The thing about parasites, which I think is real interesting, is they only survive if they're not too successful. Right? Too many parasites in the digestive tract, you die and they die. Right? Too many thieves in the dealer's room, dealers stop coming, there's no dealer's room. Right? Too many people stop paying their taxes, you look like grease. Right? So there's a natural limit to how effective you can be. Too many spammers on email, and we all stop reading email, and no one reads the spam. Right? So there's kind of a stopgap, which means there's a fundamental tension between cooperating and defecting. Right? We as individuals versus us collectively as society. I mean, I don't know. To take stealing as an example, right? You know, we all might want each other's stuff. But we all do better if we live in a society where no one steals. Right? We all might not want to pay for government, but we all are better off living in a society where everyone pays their taxes. You know, and I guess even more interesting, we're better off if everyone cooperates but us. Right? So things are bad if everyone steals. Things are because, you know, society is a low trust where nothing good happens. Things are good if no one steals, I'm sorry, because we get to live in a society where there's no theft and you know, property rights are respected and all is good. But things are really, really good if I live in a society where nobody steals and I steal. Right? Because I get all the benefits of living in a low theft society and I get your stuff.
If everyone steals in society, then you can trust that everyone steals.
Yes, and that's
different
consistent, yes.
Different system of trust, though.
Right, but, yeah, I'm gonna hit that later. So, right, so but if everybody thinks like I do, then society collapses. Now, society doesn't, right? Most of us realize this. Most of us realize that it's in our long-term best interest to not always follow our short-term self-interest. Unlike, say, chimpanzees. Or more to the point, baboons. Baboons have no impulse control. But not everybody does. Right? And that's why we need security. That is fundamentally the point of security in society. Right? How, security is how we enforce social norms. Security is how we keep the number of defectors down to some acceptable minimum. Right? Not eliminate defectors. Right? It's not zero. You know, we're doing really good at eliminating theft at this convention, but it's not down to zero. It's at a low enough level that we all feel safe here, that we're all comfortable coming. Right? And security is how we induce that cooperation, which in turn induces people to act trustworthy, which in turn induces trust. Right? That's the mechanism. Now, as note that I'm not making any claims about the moral stance of the social norms being enforced. I mean, I'm a security guy, so I really look at attackers versus defenders, and it doesn't matter who the good guys are. Right? So this fundamental model works for, you know, groups of citizens enforcing social norms about crime. It works for communities of criminals enforcing social norms about, you know, not informing the police on your cohort. It works for immoral norms of society. Right? It could be a group of slaveholders enforcing norms to ensure that slaveholding continues. Right? The security mechanisms will be the same. And even though the absolute morality is different. So I want to make sure you understand I'm separating those out. I'm not really looking at mechanisms. So given this definition of security, I look very broadly at how we as a society induce this conforming to group norms. And I have four basic mechanisms. I call them societal pressures because they really are pressures. Right? They're ways society puts its finger on the scales. I mean, I'm sitting here deciding, should I steal or not? Right? Here are the call. You know, if I steal, I get this good stuff. If I don't steal, this is what happens. Right? Society wants to put its finger on the don't steal scale, right, to make me more likely not to steal. So we have a series of pressures that we bring to bear on these questions. And right, they don't bring them down to zero. They bring them to some manageable level. So the first one is something I call morals. And by morals, I'm saying very, very generally. I mean stuff that goes on in your head. Right? Most of us don't steal, not because it's illegal, because we know it's wrong. So feelings of guilt, of shame, senses of fairness, altruism, equitability. I mean a lot, there are lots of things in our head that are naturally used, that we naturally use to behave in an altruistic manner. There's a lot of complexity. I'm blowing right through it. There are books written, on this point. You know, what goes on in our head? How did it appear evolutionarily? Right? What are the mechanisms? How do they work? A lot of good writing on this. But that's stuff that keeps most of us, most of the time, cooperative. Now, there's also reputation. It's a really interesting one. As a social species, we care a lot about how others think about us, how others respond to our actions. And a lot of times, right, we behave cooperatively because we don't want to be perceived as uncooperative. And you know how the mechanisms work. They're all informal. We're praised for good behavior. We're snubbed for bad behavior. In extreme cases, we could be ostracized from whatever social group or society. In prehistoric times, that basically meant death. You're kicked out of your social group. And you start thinking about it. These mechanisms work all the time, right? I mean, if I invite a friend over and he steals my sweater, I'm not going to call the police. I'm just not going to invite him over anymore, right? And getting invited over is fun. We all like getting invited over to our friends' houses, so we don't steal their sweaters, right? We don't. I mean, and that works. And so it's a great work on reputation. On how we think about ourselves and each other, how we deal with reputation information. We are, as a species, we're very sensitive to both how our reputation is perceived and how we perceive others' reputations. There's even a good theory that language was invented to trade reputation information. Now, we're not the only species that deals in reputation. I mean, lots of other primates recognize individuals and know, you know, whether they can be trusted or not. But we are the only species that could transfer reputation information. Right? I can tell you about him. That's a big deal. Right? No other animal has learned that trick. Right? That allows our society to scale. You're all wearing a badge for this convention that conveys reputation information. Right? If that badge is taken away from you, we can all learn some new reputation information. Right? You don't get a badge. Right? And that'll determine how we treat you. Sometimes subtly, sometimes very overtly. It's a great experiment. It shows how sensitive we are to reputation information. This was done at a university. There's a psych department. They had a coffee pot and an honesty box. The basic idea was it's a pot of coffee. Whenever you take a cup of coffee, you drop a quarter in the box. And it's kind of neat. You can actually measure people's honesty pretty exactly, right? You can measure the amount of coffee drunk. You can see the amount of money taken. And you know what percentage of people paid and what percentage of people didn't. Right? You can plot that. You know exactly. So what the experimenters did is behind the coffee pot, they put a picture of a pair of eyes. Right? And the control was a picture of flowers. And for like 8 weeks, they alternated week in, week out. And they found that the eye weeks had a much higher payment rate. Man, it's a great experiment. I mean, just the notion, just being reminded that someone might be watching makes people more honest. So these two societal pressures, morals and reputation, are old. They're very old, right? They're as old as human society. They're actually even older than humanity. You can see both morals and reputation in other primates and sometimes in other mammals, sometimes also in corvids. Right? So, social species trade on this. And I think of this as our primitive societal pressure toolkit. That worked pretty well in our hunter-gatherer groups of about 150, but society scales and they no longer work, right? We suddenly need more things. So the third type of societal pressure I call organizational, which is basically laws. Laws, if you think about it, are formalized reputation. In a law, we codify what the norm is, we delegate some subset of us to enforce it, we have prescribed penalties or rewards. Right? It's like my friend stealing my sweater, but now we have a whole system to deal with that. So when someone actually robs a bank, right, does something, something bigger.
What rewards
You can think of tasks. So much more you have penalties, but rewards are our tax incentives, are common rewards, subsidies. I mean, there's just ways of influencing behavior.
Contracts
is separate, but that's also a good one. Usually laws deal in penalties, occasionally deal in rewards. I mean, you could argue rewards are a better motivator. Penalties tend to be cheaper. Because if you think about it, if you've got a 90% compliance rate, do I really want to reward 90% of you or penalize 10% of you? Right? It's much cheaper to go after the few defectors than it is to reward the many cooperators, especially because most people are going to cooperate anyway. So that's why you tend to see more penalties than rewards. In experimental situations, rewards tend to be more effective. Right? But we just can't afford it most of the time. Right? So we have the laws, which is the third kind. The fourth kind of societal pressure is security technologies. The things that are traditional security. So think of, door locks and tall fences or alarm systems or recovery systems or forensic systems. And all of these work together. Right? I mean, take stealing. Right? Most of us don't steal because we know it's wrong. A bunch of us don't steal because of what our friends will think. Some of us won't steal because we'll go to jail. Right? And then that way up there, that little slice that's left, doesn't steal because they can't pick the door lock. So
I think this is, I mean, as a security guy, I've only really been paying attention to this little slice up here. And there's a whole lot of security that I can bring to bear on a theft problem that I might not be thinking about. I'll tell you about an experiment that's actually going on right now. There's a belief from psychology that people are more likely to steal from people they don't know, than people that are anonymous. So I'm less likely to steal from you, you know, when I see your face and I see you sitting there, than from some, you know, faceless person in the room next door, probably the room that way. Right? So an experiment is being done that can we reduce online theft out of people's bank accounts by putting a picture of them on their page. Right? So when someone hijacks the account, they say, oh, look at that nice old lady, I'm not going to steal from her. Don't know. This is the first time this has been done. We do know that there was less theft from the credit cards that had pictures on them. Citibank tried that about a decade ago. They tried that, interesting, not for this reason, they tried it as an authentication measure. Right? They wondered if store clerks would do better authenticating if there was a photograph instead of just a signature. It turned out it made no difference in authenticating. But it did make a difference in reduced fraud, and no one actually knew why. And so the belief is this is the reason. So there's now a controlled experiment. It's going on in the UK right now. And, you know, in some months we'll have actual data. And so think of these as, as pressures, right? Each individual's make a cooperate defect decision. And these pressures are how society affects that decision. And we use that to really define the optimal balance between cooperators and defectors. And this is something society never likes to talk about. You know, we never really say, you know, there aren't enough murders. But we actually do. Right? And, you know, and the debate often comes out sort of sideways. Right? The crime rate's too high. People say the streets are dangerous. You need to spend more money on police. Crime rate gets too low. People say, you know, why are we spending so much money on police? We have other problems to solve. Right? There's that optimal level. Right? Too much societal pressure is too expensive. I can reduce theft at Dragon Con, you know, very close to zero. You're just not going to like being here anymore. Right? And we as a society recognize that. There's an extraordinarily good article I actually recommend to everybody. You can Google, I think it's called Close the Prisons. Someone makes a very persuasive argument that in the United States, we send too many people to prison. And we will do better as society by letting criminals go free. Right? That punishing fewer people, that allowing for more crime, that crime is too low. I mean, you can agree or disagree with the argument. I mean, I think it makes a really good argument that's worth reading. Right? But that's the argument. You know, we're arguing what is the optimal balance? What is the optimal number of societal pressures? All right, so this model, which I do develop much more fully, I mean, I'm really, really zipping through it, I think has some very strong explanatory power. And I use it to talk about terrorism, financial crisis 2008, organized crime, internet crime. Right, there's a lot of complications here. It's kind of neat. In writing the book, I drew from a lot of disciplines. Right? I drew from, you've been hearing psychology and economics and game theory. You've heard a little bit of evolutionary biology. There's neuroscience, philosophy, anthropology, archaeology, history, poli-sci, law, theology. God, I kind of felt like I was rubbing through a university, kicking down doors and demanding answers. And that was fun. There's a lot of directions to take this. I mean, one of the hard parts of writing a book like this is putting a box around what you're going to talk about and what you're not going to talk about, because you can just go off in directions so far. I mean, as you think about it, this whole self-interest group versus group interest is really a simplistic way of looking at it. You know, often we have just many competing interests. You as an individual versus you as a community member. You as a family member versus you as a member of a greater society. You as an employee of a company versus you as a citizen. I mean, lots of different ways we think about ourselves and how those different interests use societal pressures. There's a really interesting interplay between morals and reputation because they both evolve together. It can be hard to separate them out. I mean, I've read papers that argue that you really can't separate them. I mean, I think I did for a bunch of good mechanical reasons, but I'm not sure my division makes, you know, biochemical sense. A really interesting interplay between institutional pressures in society. Right? What happens when, I mean, I'm talking about institutional pressures as the group in power enforces the rules of society, but that's not true, right? The group in power can enforce rules society doesn't like at all. And how does that work? Right? How is power co-opted? And I talk about the effects of group decision making. I mean, very often it's not individuals making decisions; it's groups making decisions. A lot of group dynamics that matter. How this plays out inside common groups and corporations, right? Profit for profit organizations in government organizations. Right? I mean, I don't have time to hit a lot of this. What I want to talk about in the remaining time before I take questions is technology. Because I think fundamentally that's more interesting to this audience. I mean, how technology affects this. And I'm fundamentally a technologist, so I'm really looking at, you know, less where we've been and more where we are and where we're going. So when you think about these societal pressures, what's interesting about them is they scale in different ways. Right, the morals are very much close in. You know, our moral qualms about behaving ill towards our kin, our kith, you know, those in our community, those in our language group, those of our species. I mean, you know, as things move out, we know the moral pressures do fade. I mean, our reputation also. I mean, the reputation in our in-group is more important than the reputation on our out-group. And of course, depending on technology, right, that there's going to be a natural reputation sphere. I mean, you know, is it the people you just talked to, or have we invented mass media or the printing press or the internet or Facebook, right, that allows reputation to scale in different ways? You know, laws too. It's sort of been a natural size of government that has changed over the centuries, you know, with technology. My town government used to matter a lot more than it does today. And then city and state government. When our country was formed, state government was on them, really mattered. And federal government was sort of after the fact. Right? That's flipped. Right? It probably flipped in the early part of last century. You know, and now today we're seeing that, you know, multi-government institutions are mattering a lot more than they did even 20 years ago. Because we are a much more global species. So when you think about technology, think about scale, right? Technology allows society to scale. And in a lot of just different ways, right? And, you know, more people is the obvious one, but increased complexity, new social systems, increased technological intensity, and you can do more things, increased frequency, decreased distance, or I guess increased in the distance you can operate. So if you think of these societal pressures as a balance between cooperators and defectors, technology advances upset the balance. Right? Someone invents gunpowder. Right? Someone invents the atomic bomb. Someone invents spam or phishing. Right? And suddenly things are different. But the security that used to work might not anymore. So in response, we have to rebalance. I mean, this is an iterative process. You're never done. But, you know, the goal is some sort of stability. The problem with this model, and I think one we're increasingly seeing, is that the attackers have a natural advantage. And it's not just a first mover advantage. Right, that the attacker gets to do something first, it's that they can make use of innovations faster. And I think of, someone invents the automobile, and the police say, well, that's a great idea. and they form a committee to study the automobile, and they come up with an RFP, they go out for bids, they get proposals, they buy an automobile, they have a training procedure, they figure out how to use it. You know, meanwhile, the bank robber says, oh, look, new getaway vehicle. Right? And can respond much faster. We actually saw this on the internet. And it, you, I don't know if you remember, it was with the internet starts getting used for commerce, and within minutes you've got this new breed of cyber criminal who intuitively knows how to take advantage of every flaw in internet commerce to make all sorts of money. Meanwhile, the police, who have been trained on Agatha Christie novels, it takes them about a decade to catch up, to figure out how to deal with this new kind of crime. And that's what happened. So what we're seeing is something I think of as a security gap. Right? If I'm sort of plotting this, you know, over time, I'm seeing a widening gap between what the bad guys can do and what the good guys can stop them from doing. And that gap, if you think about it, is greater when there is more technology. And it is greater in times of rapid technological change, and even more strongly in times of rapid social change because of technological change. And we right now are living in the time of our species of the most technology ever and the fastest technological change ever. Right? So we're kind of in uncharted waters here. And it's sort of a grand social experiment. We're seeing more effects of this security gap than ever before. It's getting harder and harder to get the optimal pressures right. And I'm actually starting to see some rhetoric in the security community that talks a bit to this. Right, on the other hand, technology doesn't always help the bad guys first. Right, there are examples of technology helping secure things. Fingerprint technology is a great example of a technology that only helped the good guys, basically. Or a much more important one, the early part of the last century, the invention of the radio. I mean, wholly changed policing. Policemen used to be lone actors in a community. Being able to radio for backup, you know, made it what was the biggest change in policing since the invention of the policing in London in the mid-1800s. Right, and there are more modern technologically enhanced societal pressure systems. Think of technology-enhanced reputational systems. Right? Not just credit scoring, but eBay feedback or Yelp. I mean, some of those crowdsourced reputational systems. Writing helped moral pressure scale. Right? Writing is a really interesting technology because it allows moral codes to be transmitted in ways other than word of mouth. But all sorts of technologies that help laws be enforced better. And, of course, better technology is better door locks and, you know, maybe better technological security. So one more problem, then some closing thoughts, and I'll take questions. I said this earlier. Society isn't always right. It's really important to remember. I've been talking about group interest versus self-interest and how the group enforces the group interest. It is not necessarily the case that the group is correct in any absolute moral terms, or that we might even know that the group is correct. Right? So you think of police informants. A really interesting example. Right? In the community of the mafia, the informant is the defector, right? The mafia security tries to stop them. But we believe that whistleblowers are morally correct, right? In the greater community, conscientious objectors, civil disobedience. You know, history has lots of examples of the defectors looking back at history being in the right. And I think it's a really interesting societal mechanism we have. Right, that in a lot of cases, social change is primed by people at the fringes of our society who are doing things to undermine our society for reasons that, you know, it turns out when you look back through history, are moral. All right, so a couple of final points. One, no matter how much societal pressure you deploy, there always will be defectors. Right? You can never get the defection rate down to zero. There's some great game theory models that describe exactly how this works, which I talk about in the book and I kind of ignored here. But you'll never get it down to zero. Right? Increasing societal pressure isn't always worth it. Right? You get diminishing returns as you add more security. It also has lots of side effects. Right? And increased societal pressures can prevent cooperation as well. And you have a lot more security, you have a lot more false positives, a lot more punishing the innocent, and the innocent stop doing the thing. Right? So you have these interesting revenge effects. And moreover, we all defect at some times and in some things. Nobody is 100% cooperative. Nobody. Right? That's okay. Right? There are good defectors and there are bad defectors, and sometimes we can't tell the difference. Right? And lastly, society needs defectors. We all benefit from the fact that some people don't follow the rules. Right? That's where social change comes from. So that's a lot in a little time. Almost everyone stayed, so I think that's a good sign. So I'm happy to take questions for a while. And you were the first one I saw. This is being recorded for posterity, or somebody's posterity.
Hi, thanks for being here. I was wondering if you could comment on when governments do what would be perceived as a bad act when they are in fact supposed to be enforcing the social mores of the group. For example, Flames and Stuxnet seem to be a bad act from people who are supposed to be, you know, enforcing laws.
Right. Well, there's a lot here that really touched peripherally on my topic, which is what happens when someone in power gets power. And then there's a lot of, they end up doing a lot of work trying to retain power, right? And less work trying to do whatever it is that brought them to power. And there's a lot of weird dynamics going on there. But you have that pretty much all the time. That as soon as we elect someone among us to speak for us, that, you know, what we want is for that person to share our interests, our agenda. Right? I want, you know, him to be able to speak for us. But as soon as I single him out, he starts having his own agenda, which is similar. But, you know, being in power is fun, he wants to keep it, you know, or maybe it's horrible, he wants to get rid of it. You know, I hire a house painter, and I pay him, and what I want is for him to have the exact same interest in a pretty house that I do. But in fact, he doesn't. He kind of wants now to do a good job and you know, get paid. So he'll cut corners in ways I wouldn't. I mean, the proxy mechanism, right, the fundamental proxy mechanism inherently fails, inherently isn't perfect. We have a lot of security to try to make that as good as possible. Someone mentioned contracts, right? Contract is a recourse mechanism, right? That if we have a contract and you don't do what I want you to do, I can like haul you into court and say, bad person, beat him up, make him give me money, whatever it is. Right? Government has that mechanism too, in theory. Right? You know, bad politician, no re-election. We all know how that works, right? Because then, I mean, this is the arms race. Then there's, can those in power figure out how to influence, subvert, eliminate elections? I mean, honestly, it would be way easier if you just elected me dictator. Right? It would be. I'm not lying. It actually would be easier. But there's reasons we don't do that. So that's the flavor of where that's going. I mean, that's his own book. And there are books that really talk about that. I saw a hand back there first. Oh, yeah, okay.
So I apologize if you've written about this in the book. I'm about halfway through and I'm really enjoying it, so thank you.
You read the first half, right?
Yes.
Good. Yes. Yeah, that's why they're numbered, you know, those chapters.
Yeah. So interesting, following on from this is what happens when the defectors start to become a little bit of the majority? I would imagine that as that starts to become closer, there's more of a force to stop the defectors from becoming the majority from the people that are the compliers.
Yeah, I mean, it'll depend, right? It'll also depend on what the dynamics are. I mean, an example we all know is file sharing. Right? You know, right? File sharing is theft. You've all been taught that, right? But there was a time on the net where it's the social norm. and the minority becomes the majority. And well, and what do those in power do? Panic.
Yeah.
Right?
And you so when you have things like the independence here, like the Arab Spring and things like that, when we look back at them, they're the right things to have done. What brings it so that the defectors become the majority, and then all of a sudden they're the actual compliers,
right,
and the people are...
Right, I mean, and there's a switch. So you'll see that, you know, we will see that in... We've seen that with what? The treatment of gays. You know, when that switch, that became, you know, from not okay to okay. Or and I think we will see it with marijuana. You know, maybe not in our lifetimes, but sooner or later, they will be a switch. Where what was deviant behavior was, you know, think of how far we've gotten. We've gotten from I smoked but didn't inhale to I'm not going to talk about that to of course I inhaled, that was the point. In the space of what? 16 years? That's really impressive. So, I mean, so you are going to see points of social flip. You know, I mean, I think it's a whole lot of chaos theory. That, you know, you can point to things and make this flip or that flip, but I don't think you can make general statements. That the same thing that worked to flip here doesn't work to flip there. And I think you've got a very complex, chaotic system. A system of perception, of group perception. You know, for some things, it's just a matter of the old perception dying. Right, a lot of social change happens when, you know, the old generation dies off. And then the new generation says, you know, what was the big deal of that? I had no idea. And so, right, you know, black serving in the military. It was a huge controversy. No one could figure out why. And you fast forward 30 years, no one will know why gays in the military is a huge controversy. No one will remember. I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. And there are people who study group behavior. There's someone I know who studies when crowds flip from mostly cooperative behavior to everyone out for himself behavior. Right? And there is a switch. And it's not at all obvious when it happens.
Isn't it a big event? Big catalyst event?
It seems not to be. I mean, that's the surprising thing about it. This person actually studies footage from European football matches. I mean, it's a great data set. And he's trying to figure out, you know, what is it about crowd dynamics that makes some fights get bigger and some get smaller? And it really seems to be little things. It's not, you know, whether it's a big event. It's a myth that people panic in crowds. People really tend not to. It's actually very surprising for most people, because we've all been told that in crowds there's a big thing that happens, everyone panics. It actually doesn't happen. So there are people looking at this.
So that was so interesting, I almost forgot, but what I wanted to ask. I wanted to return to that theory you talked about the evolution of language based on a need to trade reputational mm-hmm. information. I'm a linguist, so that's very interesting to me, and I was wondering if you could refer me to a paper or an author or a search term.
You know, email me. I can't do it off the top of my head, but I can get you references.
Sure, thank you.
I think Dennett talks about it. He's a philosopher in Australia. And there are others. I mean, and the idea is that language, that gossip is social grooming. And one of the ways our species scales, I mean, the thing about grooming is you only groom one other person. You can't pick flies off a lot of people. Right? You only pick them one at a time. Mm-hmm. So that naturally limits how many people you can trade this social currency with. Language allows social currency to scale. Right? I could tell all of you a juicy rumor, right, and I get the social benefit, but I get it, you know, to 100 people at once. It's way more efficient than I've had to pick fleas off every one of you one at a time. Right, so there's some really interesting theories of language that as trading reputational information and allowing that kind of social grooming behavior to scale. But please email me, and I will get you references, because I know they exist. Daniel Dennett, thank you. His latest book, I'm blanking on the name. It's books are now on my Kindles, never look at them anymore, right? So I forget. You
don't leave an interesting cover.
Right. So you. It's funny. I saw a copy of Debt the other, like, 2 days ago. I never knew what it looked like, and it's bigger than I thought.
Going back to the credit cards with the pictures on them, I was wondering if they were actually, the pictures were effective, not because of looking at them from the criminal and saying, oh, look at that cute baby or whatever, but because they're thinking, even though the cashier doesn't look, they think, well, the cashier might look, so this credit card's not worth it. So it's kind of like the illusion of the security is as good as the security.
Perfectly reasonable theory. I mean, a lot of people have said that. You know, we do know the cashiers didn't look, but of course, right, there's going to be some effect of, well, I don't know if I can get away with this, but I don't want to look like this guy. We don't know. I mean, no one did any experiments. You know, Citibank tried it. It didn't work. They didn't like it. It was too expensive. Whatever it was, so they pulled it. So we haven't seen controlled experiments which will let us, you know, let us know the answer. But that's a perfectly reasonable theory. And probably actually, you know, more likely than the empathy, right, that it triggered empathy. You know, the question is going to be how much of it is empathy trigger. And if we could somehow, do, you know, with good experimentation, peel those two apart, we'll know. But, you know, out in the field with the Citibank cards, there was no testing.
This actually may come across as sort of a silly question, but do you have any idea of for how to the transmission of trust? Because, you know, I'm dealing with a friend has become at this point who really does not trust the people in her neighborhood at all, you know, to the point of, you know, locking doors all the time, you know, answering the door with a gun because she's so freaked out. But it's kind of hard to explain to her, you know, but then again, you know, I don't lock the doors on my car at all, and I've never had anything taken out of it, right. You know, so it's not necessarily, it's her perception. I don't know.
So we're veering away from my area of expertise, right, you know, sort of pretty rapidly. I mean, a lot of what I'm looking at is more group behavior than individual behavior. I mean, certainly there's this huge variations in individual trust. And the people who study this, you know, look at people's experiences, how people are modeling the world, how people are seeing themselves as active versus passive inside the world. There's a lot of psychology on this. I mean, from what I look at, it's much more the sociological trends, right? How this works in groups. Individuals and trust is a lot out there. It's just, you know, I'm just not good at it. You know, right, there's extreme paranoia. I mean, there's a real live psychological disorder that, you know, we do know about that some people just have, and then there are high trust and low trust people, and it's also, it depends on the environment. We could be very trusting here, we'll go outside, and, you know, not so much, you know, or in this city, okay, but you know, and some of it's real. I mean, we do organically gain trust information from our environment. I mean, you kind of know about your neighborhood's safety. There's distorted perceptions. You know, right? Post 9/11 America, right? Uniform, distorted perception.
So earlier you talked about the need for a balance between managing the detractors and, you know, just letting everything else sort of run a little free. The mechanisms for that, is that free market, good communication? And how did that get awry when we started having proxy officials, like having the TSA respecting the government rather than respecting us?
You know, I use the TSA as a pretty complex case study in the book, because they're a really interesting example of, you know, of a group. You know, sort of very abstractly, we all together have decided that this TSA is in charge of protecting our security in airports. And, you know, how'd that go so wrong? Right, it's a pretty reasonable question to ask. So, I plotted out, you know, what the different interests are and who is beholden to who, and you see a very complex system, you know, which doesn't really map our collective desires onto this subset of us. And this isn't new. I mean, you know, why is the army sacking our village? It's our village. You know, this stuff is old. And I'm sure where I was going with this. It's I lost. What is the balance coming? You know, a lot of it is rebalancing, and I think we've gotten. You know, we're living in a time of very rapid change, and those who are learning how to take advantage of the change faster are doing much better. and that usually means, you know, moneyed and powerful interests. So things are harder right now, but in general, you do this through rebalancing. Sometimes rebalancing is long and bloody. It's the American Revolution, right? Sometimes it's as simple as, you know, an election. You know, so it depends on the kind of change. But you look back at the history of social change, it's often not pretty. You know, we can make changes around the edges, but real social change requires the people in power giving up power, and they usually are loath to do that.
This is a biographical question. What brought you to the security field and to write this book?
And it's an interesting question. I mean, I consider my career sort of an endless series of generalizations. Right? I've always been a meta guy. I'm always trying to figure out what the context is. Right? So my first book is in cryptography, which is math. Right, in the context of mathematical cryptography in our world are computers, and then the context is networks, and then suddenly I'm working in sort of security technology and computer-aided systems like voting or ID cards. Then I'm doing general security technology, more like airport security and security systems. Maybe about 8 years ago, I started looking at the economics of security. About 4 years ago, five, started looking at the psychology of security. And this is really the philosophy or sociology of security. I mean it's sort of, I'm just trying to figure out.
Going from the hard sciences to the soft sciences.
I know, it's right. And when I was a student, I hated the soft sciences because they didn't make any sense. But it turns out that's why they're interesting. Right, so, I mean, so what's leading me here is an attempt to really understand. I mean, why do people have security and rocks don't? On the one hand, it's a dumb question. On the other hand, well, tell me why.
Rocks don't care.
Right. So what does that mean? I mean what does it mean to care? Why? What's going on? So I'm really trying to understand the context of security in our society, in our world. And I really think a lot of the mechanisms are not – this is going to sound more grandiose than I mean it. I think they are fundamental mechanisms by which any species would have to deal with the problem of group interest, self-interest, and individuals. I mean, just like Darwin came up with some very general theories of how any type of life would have to work – I think these theories are similarly general, that if you find people on other planets, as long as they are individuals and they have self-interest, you're going to have these sorts of mechanisms.
But our security is mostly based on our morality, not on other moralities necessarily. Social norms as opposed to morality are two different things.
Yeah, but you know, yes and no. I mean, there are social norms, and there's been a lot of great work on the neuroscience of morality, which I'm not gonna do any justice to. But there's some they've been putting people in brain scanners and asking them moral questions, finding which parts of the brain light up. You know, what's being done by type 1 cognition versus type 2 cognition. Really interesting stuff. And there's a lot of morality that turns out to be extraordinarily hardwired. Right, some of it's cultural, right? Which fork do you use? Or and some of it's really important, like which side of the road do you drive on? I mean, we all have to agree, otherwise there's a lot of crashes, but it fundamentally doesn't actually matter. So some of it is very human, and you see in other primates, some of it is wholly cultural, a lot of it is a mixture, and you almost can't tell the difference. Right? Sometimes you go to a different culture, and they substituted one for another, and you know they both work. We might consider that one immoral, but it works just as well, and they might view us as immoral. Some of them, if you take the view of a philosopher, they are more absolutely moral by some moral precepts that you might agree are better than others. There's a lot here, but it's not nearly as cut and dry as that. So I think I have to couple more questions. She says one more question. I say two more questions.
You hinted about this in the talk a little bit, but with the example of the mafia and the defector, I thought it was interesting that you said that the guy who ratted out the mafia was the defector, rather than the mafia being the defector group. And so you essentially have this two-group system, mm-hmm. where you have the mafia and you have the government. And, you know, morals aside, it's, you know, they can be on even playing field. Or you might look at, like, Russia and the United States and mm-hmm. that sort of two-group system there. I was wondering if you talk about two-group or three-group or N-group systems at all and how the group theory works or game theory works with that.
Right, I do. In the book, I have a whole chapter on that because it really is the interesting question. I mean, and it's going to be... Right, and the mafia is a great example. You know, one is your crime family, which actually spends a lot of time, and they use the words family. I mean, they're trying to really push your buttons that this is where your loyalties lie, right? This is your family. We're not just a bunch of criminals. We're a crime family. And they do a lot of other social cohesion things to make you, given when you get a choice between following the group interest of the mafia versus the group interest of the greater society, you'll pick the mafia. I mean, so there's a lot going on. What are some other examples of that? When you're inside a corporation, the interesting question is, why do perfectly honest people perform criminal acts at their jobs? Happens a lot.
Where have you found a perfectly honest person?
Okay, it's reasonably honest people. I mean, people who, if you ask them, would say, no, that's immoral, and will do it almost without thinking. Or Nazism, although, you know, we try to steer away from that topic, just on a general rule. Right, you know, so why is it that regular people commit dishonest acts when they don't even really benefit from them? And so a lot of work is done on social identity and group identity and how that works. Yeah. Yes, well, some of it is helping out a friend versus, you know, we are a very social species. If I come to you and say, you know, I really need this help, I screwed up, it's the end of the week, my job's on the line, just backdate this document for me, come on. Right, you'll say, well, sure, why not, you're a friend, I mean, we're all those together, I'm going to help you. And that kind of thing will snowball, and before long, people are engaging in widespread fraud. And psychologists have gone into some of the banks that did this and plotted the way this worked. It's really interesting work. But yes, I mean that I think is fundamentally an interesting question, because it's rarely, you know, should I steal or should I not steal is a very really artificial dilemma. It's Les Misérables, right? Should I feed my family or should I respect the law and not steal? Right? That's very different, because in both cases, I can make a moral argument. There are scale discussions. A lot going on there. That's bigger. All right. So with that, I'm gonna kick you all out of the room. Actually, I'm not. I'm just gonna leave the room. You can stay. Thank you for coming. I'm back in this room at 5:30 for a discussion of government laws. At 10:00 tomorrow, I'm in this room talking about cyber war. And at 11:30, I am somewhere, I still don't know where, doing a book signing. What?
At the Marriott Marquis,
which is a big hotel. I'll be in some room in that hotel. Thank you very much.